I just want to welcome you to this this session. I guess this is the session 271, and this session is going to deal with as advertised with a forthcoming book on the gospel topics essays. And I'm going to give you a bit of an overview of our presenters, and they will be presenting in somewhat different order than are listed in the program. I'll beginning with an introductory overview of what the volume is about that we're going to be talking about. It's a forthcoming volume on the Gospel Topics Essays. It's going to be published by University of Utah Press in 2018. And after I give a brief introduction, our first presenter will be Matthew L. Harris, who is actually, he's the senior partner in this enterprise. He actually recruited me, twisted my arm, and convinced me to join him in this venture. And so I actually, he's the one that really deserves the primary credit for the putting together of this volume. He's a full professor of history at Colorado State University. He's published extensively in the field of American history, two works dealing with the larger topic of American history, the Founding Fathers and the Debate Over Religion in Revolutionary America, and Zublin Pike, Thomas Jefferson and the Opening Up of the American West. He's also the co-editor with me of a volume most recently entitled The Mormon Church and Blacks, which was published in 2015. And he's currently at work on a myriad of projects. This guy, he's got to be the hardest working guy that I've ever known. I mean, he's got three, four simultaneous book projects all going on at the same time. Including two of them are Ezra Taft Benson. One of them is the one that we're talking about today on the Gospel Topics essays. And then he's doing a seminal study on blacks within the church since 1945. Our second presenter, to follow Matt, is Gary James Bejera. He hardly needs any introduction. His work, I'm sure, is known to all of you in this room. He's the author editor of some 7 to 8 books. The most notable, Conflict in the Quorum, Brigham Young, then a biography or institutional history of Brigham Young University, House of Faith. And he's got his most recent publication, which is I think it's out in print now. It's an editorship of the Leonard Arrington Diaries. Is that out in print now? It'll be out in the fall. So look for that. That's quite a work. And then last but certainly not least is I call her maybe the quintessential Sunstoner. Is that the right? Sorry, that's maybe not the right way to put it. That has negative connotations, but Margaret is kind of an institution at Sunstone. She is, and she's also with the institution of University of Utah, an associate professor of classics and comparative studies here at the U. And her research centers on myth, religion, and gender in both ancient and modern contexts, and has published extensively on Mormon feminism over some 30 years. For me, her classic work is Strangers in Paradox. I love that title. That she and her husband, Paul, authored together. I mean, it's a classic work, and I after all this time, I think it still stands up very well. And so, anyway, they're each going to present. I guess I should tell you what they're going to present on. Matt is going to be talking about the Race and the Priesthood essay, its strengths and weaknesses. Gary is going to be talking about Joseph Smith and the beginnings of plural marriage, subtitled Through a Glass Darkly. I love that title. And then Margaret is going to be dealing with the priesthood, temple, and woman's essay, deconstructing Joseph Smith's teachings about thereof. I just want to give a brief overview of what's in the other essays in the volume and briefly mention the authors. As I say, we were very fortunate in being able to recruit a whole series of scholars who had specialization in the particular essays that we want them to write on. And the first essay in the volume is Are Mormons Christian? And the author of that is Craig Bloomberg, who is a professor of New Testament at Denver University Seminary. The second essay in the volume is it's a critique of Becoming Like God. And the author of that essay is Richard Sherlock, professor of philosophy at Utah State University, and he's co-authoring the critique of the Becoming Like God with Carl Mosser, who's with the Center for Philosophy of Religion at Notre Dame University. And then we have two essays that center on the Book of Mormon. You know, there were two gospel topics essays that were issued on the Book of Mormon. And critiquing the first of those essays, Book of Mormon and DNA Studies, is Thomas W. Murphy, a professor of anthropology at Edmonds Community College, and he's co-critiquing that with Angelo Baca, who's with the Department of Anthropology at New York University. So you can see we've got authors that are involved in this that are both from a Mormon tradition, Latter-day Saint tradition, and from outside the LDS tradition, younger scholars, older scholars, and the author of the Book of Mormon translation, the critiquing the Book of Mormon translation essay is John Charles Duffy, visiting assistant professor at Miami University. And doing the first vision accounts, the various critiquing the first vision accounts essay is David J. Hallett, who is a visiting assistant professor of religion at Skidmore College. And then the Peace and Freedom, or Peace and Violence among 19th Century Latter-day Saints, critiquing that particular topics essay is John G. Turner. You might have heard him. He's the author of the definitive biography on Brigham Young. Turner is a professor of religious studies at George Mason University. And as I mentioned, the plural marriage in Kirtland and at Nauvoo essay is Gary, who will have more to say about that in his presentation. And the author of the critique of plural marriage and families in Utah, early Utah, is George D. Smith, who needs no introduction. He presented this morning, those of you who were here. And then the manifesto and the end of plural marriage. So there are three essays that focus on plural marriage, which is interesting, more on plural marriage than any other topic. The third one, it deals with the manifesto, the end of plural marriage. And that's done by yours truly. I've written that particular essay. And the race and priesthood essay, as I mentioned earlier, that's Matt Harris, and he'll have more to say of that in his presentation. And then the critiquing of the translation and historicity of the Book of Abraham, Stephen Taysom, professor of religion at Cleveland State University, is doing that one. And then the last two focus on women, the place and role of women in the church. One of those is Mother in Heaven. That's the gospel topics on essay on that. And we have two younger scholars that are critiquing that one. Caroline Klein, a PhD candidate in religion at Claremont Graduate University, and Rachel Hunt Steinblick, a PhD candidate in philosophy and religion at Claremont Graduate University. And then the last essay, and certainly not least, is Margaret, who has done Joseph Smith's teaching about priesthood, temple, and women. And as I say, she'll have more to say about that in her essay. I just want to briefly deal in my remarks with a little bit of what's in the introduction, which centers on the basic question, why the gospel topics essays? That, of course, is in essence, the bringing forth of the gospel topics essays is part of a larger effort by the LDS Church to promote greater transparency in presenting Mormon history and doctrine. Much of the impetus for this church effort has came from church president Thomas B. Monson early in his ministry. He, along with other church leaders, became alarmed over the increasing number of church members that had become disaffected or experienced so-called crises of faith and had gone inactive or had completely left the church. Disaffections resulting from discovering, many of these disaffections resulting from discovering unsettling information dealing with controversial aspects of Mormon history and doctrine. Also, often these people finding, these church members finding information online. And this had occurred with increasing frequency over the last two decades. In confronting this crisis, church leadership commissioned and participated in the production of the Gospel Topics Essay, which together are designed to acknowledge openly and candidly the highly controversial topics and aspects of the history that I, you know, mentioned in the titles of the essays itself. The actual process of writing was actually done by committee through a multi-layered process. Basically, an initial draft was written. An expert, a faithful Mormon scholar, somebody that who had knowledge of the particular topic under consideration, was approached and asked to draft an essay explaining this particular race and the priesthood thing that Matt will be talking about. Paul Reeve was the initial first author of that essay. And then that was sent out to other scholars who had a similar knowledge about the topic. And they came back with their suggestions, additions, whatever, corrections. And then it went back to church headquarters, to the actual church history department, where in-house historians went over and did drafts and revisions of the similar essays. And then as those were refined further modified, they were gradually moved up the hierarchical level until they reached the level of the 12 and the first presidency, who were the final ones to sign off, and then they were posted online. That's kind of the process. I'm giving an oversimplified view, but that's basically the process of how these essays were composed. And once they were out there, and they started posting them online. The first one was posted and put online in November of 2013. The last one was posted some 2 years later in October of 2015. So this process of actually getting them out there took place over that two-year period. And it's interesting to note that the initial rollout of these essays, once they were completed, was very, very, very low-keyed, deliberately. This was done deliberately, demonstrating, I think, and others have agreed with me, the church leaders' extreme ambivalence in exposing church members to the controversial topics at issue. Apart from a handful of interviews that Stephen Snow, who is the church historian, gave to journalists, there was no news releases, no fanfare. Church officials strategically buried the essays on the church website in an effort to minimize their exposure. This, according to reliable sources that Matt and I have been able to unearth. The first presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve declined to sign the essays or to publish them in the Ensign, the official church magazine. The essays received no exposure in general conference and minimal exposure in church meeting houses when they were first rolled out. The only acknowledgement the senior leaders made during that first year of 2014 with the first statements was from the LDS newsroom and a private memo from the church priesthood department addressed to church leaders from the general authority level, from the highest level down to the ward level. Not surprisingly, this low-keyed release posed significant challenges for those Latter-day Saints on the ward level who began to teach from them. One report noted that few Mormons seemed to know about him, while some rejected the idea that they bore the imprimatur of the church. This, in turn, led to confusion, evident in one kind of crazy case where a Sunday school teacher in Hawaii taught portions from one of the essays to his youth Sunday school class and was promptly released by his bishop for being accused of teaching from unauthorized sources. I find that pretty wild. Scores of comparable stories dot Mormon blog sites. Well, finally, in 2015, after this process had been going on for 2 years, church leaders started recognizing the problem and moved to implement measures to try to remedy this. In September of that year, Apostle Russell M. Ballard, an indefatigable proponent of the essays, I must give him credit for that, referred to them at a conference at a regional conference in Utah, asserting that, quote, the church is dedicated to transparency and has donated precious resources to provide new insights and offer even more context to the story of the restoration. 5 months later, in February 2016, Apostle Ballard reiterated his concern to a group of church education teachers, admonished them to learn these essays like you know the back of your hand, adding that, and I think this is a great quote, gone are the days when a student asked an honest question and a teacher responded, don't worry about it. That same year, church officials began including the essays as background reading for students at Brigham Young University and in the church education system, providing supplementary materials to the lesson manuals. And moreover, church officials have started authorizing the incorporation of the essays into revised curriculum for LDS young adults, dealing with sensitive issues, and commissioned scholars to carry out the process of revision. In 2016, leaders approved of a Gospel Topics app so that Latter-day Saints could find the essays quickly and exponentially. In addressing the issue of why this church was slow in promoting the essays, church historian Stephen Snow frankly acknowledged, well, it was a soft rollout. And then with kind of a touch of ironic humor, he confessed that the announcement was not saying, and I quote this kind of tongue-in-cheek, it was not an announcement that you can go to the website to learn everything weird about the Mormon Church that you've ever wanted to learn. This reflected the fact that Snow and his fellow general authorities understood that the essays were controversial and that some of them repudiated earlier teachings from earlier church leaders. I just want to conclude, and then turning this over, just a couple of concluding remarks. Nonetheless, these admissions, some Latter-day Saints have praised the essays as a real blessing, reflective of a maturing church. LDS church historian Richard Bushman, whom all of you have probably heard of, author of Rough Stone Rolling, the biography of Joseph Smith, also praised the essays, commending church leaders for their candidness and openness. And he goes on to state, the best way to prevent Latter-day Saints from suffering a crisis of faith upon discovering these, certain disturbing facts is that you need to inoculate members from the very beginning by telling the whole story, particularly to young people as they're coming up. And I guess in conclusion, perhaps First President's Counselor Dieter Uchtdorf put it best when he explained, quote, truth and transparency complement each other. We always need to remember that transparency and openness keep us clear of the negative side effects of secrecy or the cliche of faith promoting rumors. Thank you.
Did I just lose that? So it's a pleasure to be here today. How many of you have read the Race and Priesthood essay? I'm just curious. Show of hands. Wow, quite a few of you. So how many of you know it like the back of your hand? Apparently you're bad Latter-day Saints, because that's what Apostle Ballard counseled. I had to say that to this crowd. I just wanted to say that. All right, so today I want to offer some remarks about my critique of the Race and Priesthood essay, and certainly in the interest of time in a venue like this, I need to be brief. And so I'm going to be brief when I explain to you, at least to review some of the salient points of the essay. I think it's only fair to explain to you what's in the document first before I start to critique. So I'll do that briefly. And I want to focus on one part of the critique today. So it's just one part. Rather than do a whole bunch of minor critiques, my favorite is, the essay makes Elder McConkie and Joseph Fielding Smith, his father-in-law, have to be racial progressives. That's a rough one. But I'm going to, in the interest of humoring you today, I'm going to bypass that. You'll have to buy the book next year and read it. So anyway, but I want to focus on something a little bit more serious today, and it's a live issue in the LDS Church. And so my talk really is centered around or framed around this idea of Mormon whiteness theology, something that the Race and Priesthood essay just omits categorically. And a lot of the stuff that I bring to you today is based on archival stuff that I've seen. Some of the stuff that I'll share with you, some of you run across it. But anyway, it's a real thing, and it's a real issue. The Race and Priesthood essay opens by quoting 2 Nephi 26:33, affirming that all are alike unto God. This popular Book of Mormon scripture sets the tone for the rest of the document, for the essay's purpose is to remind the reader that the church is truly welcoming of all races, colors, and creeds. The essay therefore affirms that Mormonism is a universalist religion because it seeks to save all of God's children. The writers craft a sweeping account explaining how the church emerged in the 19th century amidst a highly contentious racial culture in which whites were afforded great privilege. The essay affirms that the church was restored in 1830 when slavery was legal and permissible and when racial discrimination permeated American culture. The authors identify Brigham Young as the leader who implemented the priesthood and temple ban, admitting that it was the result of human error rather than divine will. The writers justify the ban, explaining that Young was simply a product of 19th century America when many people of African descent lived in slavery and racial distinctions and prejudice were not just common but customary among white Americans. Likewise, the essay candidly acknowledges that church leaders use, quote, the curse of Cain as justification for the priesthood and temple restrictions, end quote, along with another rationale that became widespread within the Mormon community by the turn of the 20th century. This is the notion that black folks were less valiant in this pre-mortality. In another important admission, the essay disavows Mormon racial teachings. The essay repudiates, for instance, past teachings about black skin, mixed-race marriages, and racial superiority. Specifically, it disavows, quote, the theories advanced in the past that black skin is a sign of divine disfavor or curse. And that's where I'm going to focus my remarks today. The essay acknowledges that a few black men had been ordained to the priesthood under the leadership of Joseph Smith, and that one of these men, Elijah Abel, participated in temple and priesthood ordinances. And this is the first time that the church had ever acknowledged, at least publicly, that black men, at least some black men, held the priesthood. The essay closes on an optimistic note, reminding leaders that the LDS Church teaches that all are alike unto God. So it starts with all are alike unto God and ends with all are alike unto God. Clearly, there's a motif going on in this essay. It affirms that God is no respecter of persons and emphatically declares that anyone who is righteous, regardless of race, is favored of him. Despite the essay's many qualities that I'll talk about at the end of the paper today, the essay is virtually silent on a crucial LDS teaching in the 20th century, namely Mormon whiteness theology. Mormon leaders who embrace this theology assert that dark-skinned peoples were cursed because of choices they made in a pre-existent life, but they also taught that God would eventually lift the curse, either in mortality or in the resurrection, where they would be made white again through conversion to the Mormon church. Put simply, baptism had the transforming capacity to physically lighten one's skin, to set dark-skinned converts on a path of racial regeneration. In the interest of time, I'm going to hold on. The Book of Mormon, as we most of us probably know in this, talks about dark skin and skins of whiteness and becoming white and delightsome when these lazy and indolent Lamanites converted to the gospel. So I'm going to forego those passages. But naturally, the Book of Mormon provided Mormon leaders a lens by which to view dark skin. During the first century and a half of the Mormon church, the LDS hierarchy was quite vocal in articulating a whiteness theology. Some Mormon leaders believed that the curse would be lifted over time, gradually returning dark-skinned people to their pre-cursed state of whiteness after their conversion. Others opined that they would return to their primitive state of whiteness in the resurrection. For Mormons then, whiteness theology was not solely, or for Mormon leaders then, whiteness theology was not solely a metaphorical or symbolic interpretation of skin color, as some LDS apologists have argued. Rather, the evidence clearly suggests that it was also a tangible, literal transformation of flesh pigmentation prompted when blacks and Native Americans converted to Mormonism. Apostle Spencer W. Kimball was the most prominent Mormon leader to teach such views. In a controversial General Conference address in 1960, he averred that when American Indians left the reservation after being baptized into the Mormon church, they became quite, quote, as light as Anglos. Kimball theorized that for years they had been growing delightsome, and they are now becoming white and delightsome as they were promised in the Book of Mormon. To underscore the point, the apostle showed a picture. So he holds up a picture in conference of 20 Lamanite missionaries claiming that 15 of the 20 were as light as Anglos and 5 were darker but equally delightsome. Additionally, he claimed... Additionally, he claimed that, quote, the children in the home placement program in Utah are often lighter than their brothers and sisters in the Hogans on the reservation. Kimball's racialized sermon elicited a flood of letters from concerned Latter-day Saints who queried the apostle about his racial teachings. Edward L. Kimball, the Mormon leader's son and principal biography, recounted to me that his father responded to his interlocutors by explaining that his sermon was a figurative expression and not an actual manifestation of changing skin color. And Ed is not an apologist. If you know the late, great Ed Kimball, he's not an apologist. And so that was struck me as strange. But nevertheless, President Apostle Kimball was not the first apostle to teach a whiteness theology. In a private meeting some 6 years earlier, Joseph Fielding Smith, Kimball's file leader in the Quorum of the Twelve at the time, bluntly admitted to LDS religious educators in a private meeting in the Salt Lake Temple that, quote, we know of cases where the dark skin of Negroes really has disappeared. Hugh Nibley, Sidney Sperry, and some other Mormon luminaries were at that meeting. Could only see Nibley scratching his head. He didn't support this stuff. And if you go through his papers, you'll see that. Smith's admission about black people is consistent with his teachings about Lamanites. In his popular book, Answers to Gospel Questions, he candidly stated that Lamanites were beginning to lose their dark pigment. Apostle Smith went on to explain that, quote, when the Lamanites fully repent and sincerely receive the gospel, the Lord has promised to remove their dark skin, end quote. Other general authorities taught a similar doctrine. Bruce McConkie, Alvin Dyer, Harold B. Lee, James Talmadge, they all taught that this process of racial regeneration at baptism. Given these racialized discourses, it is incredulous that the Race and Priesthood essay does not discuss Mormon whiteness theology in the essay. Further troubling is the fact that Mormon whiteness theology is still regnant in the Book of Mormon. This despite LDS leaders changing the phrase white and delightsome to pure and delightsome in a revised edition in 1981. As much as anything, the change reflects an intuitive awareness among LDS leadership that the revelation lifting the priesthood and temple ban in 1978 did not mitigate Mormon racial teachings. Some Mormon leaders, in fact, continue to support Mormon whiteness theology even after the revelation. In an interview in 1979 with religion reporter John Dart, Spencer W. Kimball, now as church president, acknowledged, quote, that although he did not have any scientific studies to examine the claim, he affirmed that Native Americans would turn white through spiritual rejuvenation, education, and culture, end quote. For Kimball, the white and delightsome appellation applied to all peoples the Mormons referred to as Lamanites. Now he lumps them in, Mexicans, Latin Americans, Hawaiians, Polynesians. Kimball's rugged defense of Mormon whiteness theology is not surprising, given how much it permeated Mormon culture in the 20th century. LDS Church magazines published dozens of stories discussing Native peoples, Native Americans, particularly how LDS leaders privileged Lamanites for redemption and whiteness through aggressive missionizing efforts. In the Millennial Star, for example, a periodical published by the Mormon Church in England, a writer noted in 1917 that, quote, the American Indians are becoming white in their mode of living, their education, their occupation, their ideals and aspirations. There is no doubt that this radical change will ultimately affect their complexion and their general appearance. The writer further explained that, quote, in due time, Native Americans will come under the influence of the gospel and become white and delightsome, end quote. Another LDS periodical, The Improvement Era, published a pair of stories in the 1920s illustrating the effect of conversion on Native peoples. One was about Lewis Armel, a Winnebago Indian, who allegedly turned white after joining the Mormon Church. He is, quote, said to be the object of scientific observation because for many years his skin has gradually been turning white, The Improvement Era explained. He is now 54 years of age. He still has copper patches, but physicians believe that if he lives a few more years, he will become entirely white. Another story in the Improvement Era explained that, quote, the promise of racial purity was not just reserved for those living in the last days, but was also partly fulfilled during the Nephite period when persons with dark skin repented and joined the church. Similarly, an LDS author noted in 1952 that after spending time among the Kadawa Indians in South Carolina, he noticed something different about them. They turned white after conversion. Quote, those Indians were white and delightsome, as white and fair as any group of citizens of our country, he observed. I know of no prophecy, ancient or modern, that has had a more direct and literal fulfillment. Inevitably, Mormon whiteness theology worked its way into popular culture. In a prominent LDS quiz game called Seek, published by an LDS-affiliated bookstore in 1958, the creators posed critical questions reinforcing Mormon whiteness teachings. True or false, one question asked. The Lamanites are promised that if they repent and accept the gospel, their skin color will eventually become white again. That was worth 10 points. This one's worth 5 points. Name the descendants of Lehi who were cursed with dark skin because of their wickedness. Popular children's books advanced a Mormon whiteness theology as well. Book of Mormon stories written for grade school children plainly noted that, quote, Laman and Lemuel's followers called themselves Lamanites. They became a dark-skinned people. God cursed them because of their wickedness. Another children's book noted, Nephites planted crops. They worked hard. They loved God. They built a temple. In contrast, Laman and Lemuel and their people were called Lamanites. They did not work. They were wicked. God made their skin dark. Such teachings naturally affected black Latter-day Saints. Darius Gray, a black LDS man, recalled, quote, the Book of Mormon talked about Lamanites and Nephites, primarily Lamanites, often having a dark skin and being out of favor with God. I wanted to know how that related to me. And this is when he joined the church in 1965. He had this observation. Another black LDS man, David Jackson, found Mormon scriptures deeply troubling, particularly the Book of Mormon, which, quote, explains why Lamanites receive dark skins and a degenerate status. A third black LDS man, Darren Smith, lamented how the Book of Mormon created an institutional framework where whiteness operates in opposition to people of color. The white and delightsome and dark and loathsome binary, Smith opined, allowed Mormons to view people of color as deviant and inferior. If Lamanites enjoyed a special eschatology in LDS teachings, blacks were not as fortunate. In contrast to Lamanites, Mormon leaders believed they had no corresponding role to play in removing the curse from persons of African ancestry. Likewise, missionaries did not proselytize among African Americans or Africans or make special efforts to seek them out like they did the Lamanites. The obvious inaction can be attributed to LDS racial teachings about people with Negroid ancestry, but equally difficult was the challenge of establishing the church in black nations without black priesthood authority. I might add parenthetically, they tried that as an experiment in the 1960s with Nigeria. Some of you may know the story a little bit, and it failed miserably because the Nigerians were upset that white folk from Salt Lake had to fly in from Salt Lake to run the church, and they didn't like that. So it was a failed experiment in the 60s with Nigerians. Also important was the Civil Rights Movement, which put Mormon racial policy under a spotlight. The tremendous criticism church leaders experienced after World War II made them reluctant to discuss Mormon racial teachings. The more we said about the subject, the more we shall have to explain our racial teachings, Church President David O. McKay bluntly explained in 1968 amidst heavy pressure from critics to lift the priesthood and temple ban. Nonetheless, Mormon leaders strongly affirmed that blacks would lose their dark pigment after converting to Mormonism. When Apostle Joseph Fielding Smith told LDS religious educators in a private meeting in 1954 that we know of cases where the dark skin of Negroes really has disappeared, he was not speaking metaphorically. For Smith, there were actual, tangible examples of black Latter-day Saints whose skin color turned lighter after converting to Mormonism. Furthermore, the apostle taught that the curse of Cain, or the skin of blackness, as he put it, would be removed after the rest of God's children received the holy priesthood. Here he echoed the teachings of Brigham Young, Wilford Woodruff, and other Mormon leaders, unequivocally indicating that black skin was fluid and finite. If blacks lived worthy, Smith reasoned, God would lift the curse and make them pure again. They could even inherit the celestial kingdom. As these teachings permeated Mormon culture in the last half of the 20th century, critics, not surprisingly, scoffed at how Latter-day Saints racialized themselves. In 1953, a journalist expressed disdain for the Mormon teaching that, quote, Negroes were originally white, but were then cursed for refusing to accept God. A 1959 commission investigating civil rights in Utah noted that, quote, the Negro is not admitted to barbershops and beauty parlors and teaches that by righteous living, the dark-skinned races may become white and delightsome again. That same year, a Time magazine journalist commented on the commission's report, starkly noting that the Mormon interpretation of the curse of Canaan, together with unauthorized but widely accepted statements by Mormon leaders in years past, has led to the view among many Mormon adherents that birth into any race other than the white race is a result of an inferior performance in a pre-earth life. Yet critics did not mischaracterize Mormon racial teachings. Since Joseph Smith founded the church in 1830, LDS leaders have consistently linked dark skin with evil and whiteness with purity, much in the same way that some white Protestants did in the 19th and 20th centuries. Historian John Turner notes, for example, that, quote, some European and white American Protestants speculated that the offspring of African converts to Christianity would grow progressively whiter, physically as well as morally, end quote. One of the clearest examples of Mormon racial tropes came from John Taylor, the third president of the LDS Church, who taught, quote, that the devil should have a representation upon the earth through the lineage of Cain and Ham. Likewise, Bruce R. McConkie linked Negroes with the devil in Mormon doctrine and promised that God would remove the curse of Cain in the resurrection. Moreover, in 1969, LDS leaders discreetly sought a dark-skinned person to play Satan in the temple ceremony. Ask me in Q&A what happens with that. It's a fun one. I'll just say it's a dark-skinned Polynesian. He was pissed off when he found out what they were using him for. Conversely, Mormons have long portrayed Jesus as white with Caucasian features, much as other Protestants did in the 20th century. Some LDS leaders, in fact, taught that blacks would be white in the afterlife, this despite the First Presidency declaring in 1944 that, quote, nothing yet has been revealed regarding the color of the Negro when he comes forth in the resurrection. Finally, some Mormon leaders supported eugenics at the turn of the 20th century, suggesting, in the words of one writer, a Mormon whiteness. And yet the essay does not explain these controversial teachings, though admittedly it stipulates that black skin is not a sign of divine disfavor or curse. Consequently, the essay's silence allows these whiteness teachings to persist. Today in a Book of Mormon class, a BYU student complained in 2008, I listened to one of BYU's most popular teachers describe our central scriptures as black and white. I doubt there was a single reader of this letter that doesn't already know which side he said is good and which is evil. When my teacher acknowledged that he too had sinned, he called it the black within myself. The student further lamented that he had sat in classes on this campus where tenured, highly rated professors teach that blacks will be white when they reach heaven. These teachings were not just confined to BYU. In 1998, an LDS woman called into a Utah talk show and explained that Utah Jazz forward Karl Malone bore the mark of a divine curse. "It's in the Bible," she explained, then proffered that her statement had been proven true because some Indians in Canada have turned white. I have no idea how she went from Karl Malone to Indians in Canada, but there you have it. Maybe she was in my home state where cannabis is legal. Who knows? In 2008, a black Mormon woman expressed anguish at being told by a white Mormon woman that she'd be white in the resurrection and difficult to recognize in the next life. "You're so sweet," the white woman explained. "But I just don't know how I'm going to recognize you in the celestial kingdom, because I just can't visualize you as white. So you'll have to recognize me. You'll have to come to find me." Another Black Latter-day Saint reported, quote, "I have been a member 9 years and have been told many times on many different occasions how I'll be white in heaven or how my skin is a sin or a curse." Still another Black Latter-day Saint facetiously explained, quote, that she kept getting whiter and whiter over time. And she said this in sacrament meeting, and I think half the audience as she explained it to me laughed and the other half found it sad. Either sad or they didn't get the joke. As flippant as these stories are, they mask a real pain for people of color when they experience Mormon whiteness teachings. Mormon whiteness theology, meanwhile, won't go away. In recent years, some introspective Mormons have asked themselves what it means to be a Christian, and more particularly, a Mormon Christian in a predominantly white church. Mormon blogger Mehdi Ivy Harrison, a white woman, writing in the aftermath of the mass shooting in Charleston, South Carolina in 2015, offered a candid reflection in a blog entitled, "Is White Supremacy Inherent to Mormon Doctrine?" published in the Huffington Post. She asked, "Is it enough, white America? Is it enough to make us look at ourselves and wonder, am I part of the problem? Am I doing anything to change racism?" Harrison then offered a blunt appraisal of her church's racial teachings, finding it, quote, "deeply troubling to read passages in the Book of Mormon and wonder how the term white is meant to be understood if it is not about skin color. If this is all metaphorical, as I would like to claim that it is, then why does it sound so racist?" She wished that Latter-day Saints would stop talking about skin color as a way of determining the worth of a person's soul. This tension was further heightened in 2016 when LDS leaders approved a racially insensitive song for the Young Women's Program in the church. Titled White, the song was written by a 17-year-old Asian Latter-day Saint girl who undoubtedly was not aware of Mormonism's controversial racial teachings. Because white and whiteness are so entangled with the concept and experience of race, this song is very inappropriate, Jane and Graham Russell, a black Latter-day Saint woman, intoned. "I get the doctrinal idea, but more care should be taken with anything involving the word white and the LDS church because of its history and the present experiences of black members. It's symptomatic," she continued, "of not having honest conversations about race and what has been said about whiteness and blackness in our history. It also reflects a lack of inclusive voice in positions of authority in the LDS church." In light of these stories, the race and priesthood ASM misses a critical opportunity to heal what is ostensibly an open wound for many people of color in the church. At the same time, it fails to nuance the richness and complexity of the Book of Mormon, more specifically, to clarify ambiguous passages relative to race in Mormon scripture. This point is important, for Mormon scripture affirms both a message of inclusion for people of color, that they're all alike unto God, and a message of exclusion marked by curses and future promises wherein dark-skinned people could one day become white and delightsome. Thus, the essay presents an incomplete view of race in Mormon scripture. This is not a minor quibble. During much of the 20th century, Mormon leaders appealed to the Pearl of Great Price and the Book of Mormon as proof texts to justify the temple and priesthood ban. Furthermore, the essay's omission of whiteness theology in the Book of Mormon is problematic in that the revelation of 1978 ending the ban did not clarify these important Mormon scriptures in light of the new policy change. Such problems notwithstanding, there is much to praise in the race and priesthood essay. Without question, it is the fullest, richest, and most authoritative expression to date on Mormonism's evolving racial teachings. The essay is a milestone in many ways. For the first time anywhere in Mormon writings, the church specifically denounces its anti-black teachings, disavowing by name doctrines the church once taught as authoritative and binding. This includes the divine curse, the sinful conduct of black people in a premortal life, the sin of interracial marriage. And second, leaders aver that the ban was the result of the prevailing racism of Brigham Young's era, rather than divine revelation, thus moving away from earlier characterizations of the ban when they insisted that we don't know how it began or why it began. Third, the essay marks the first time that the ban was laid squarely at the feet of someone other than Joseph Smith. Fourth, the essay candidly admits that the ban was both a temple and a priesthood restriction, rejecting the popular perception that it was solely a priesthood ban. And finally, the essay acknowledges that some black men held the priesthood during the early days of the church, clearly suggesting that Joseph Smith's position on black priesthood ordination was more permissive, inclusive, and progressive than Brigham Young's. This candid assertion marks a dramatic reversal from earlier church positions when black priesthood ordination was either denied outright or minimized altogether. Now let me conclude. As laudatory as the race and priesthood essay is, it is fundamentally deficient. It neither discusses Mormon whiteness theology nor grapples with its longstanding effect on people of color in the church. Still, I believe there is hope. The essay took the brave step of repudiating the divine curse, less valiancy assertions, and other challenging racial teachings. Here's hoping that Mormon whiteness theology is next. Thank you.
My comments will represent an abridgment of the essay that I wrote for Mattson Newell's book. The LDS Church's release on October 22, 2014, of an anonymously written, scholarly-oriented article on the beginnings of the church's past practice of plural marriage very quickly attracted considerable public attention. The essay admitted that founding prophet Joseph Smith had polygamously married some very young women, had polygamously married other men's wives, and had concealed many of his polygamous marriages from his own first wife, Emma Hale Smith. The essay represented a departure from previous church efforts to minimize, if not ignore, the controversial practice. Clearly, LDS officials decided that hard truths are the most effective palliative to potential faith-related obstacles resulting from the study of the church and plural marriage. The church's willingness to confront its past invites us to evaluate the essay and offer some observations regarding future discussion. The essay begins with a word of caution, quote, "Many details about the early practice of plural marriage are unknown. Plural marriage was introduced among the early saints incrementally, and participants were asked to keep their actions confidential. They did not discuss their experiences publicly or in writing until after the Latter-day Saints had moved to Utah and church leaders had publicly acknowledged the practice. The historical record of early plural marriage is therefore thin. Few records of the time provide details, and later reminiscences are not always reliable. Some ambiguity will always accompany our knowledge about this issue. Like the participants, we see through a glass darkly and are asked to walk by faith." End quote. All students of the history of LDS plural marriage would do well to take such advice to heart. The contemporary first-person sources for the beginnings of Mormon plural marriage are virtually non-existent. Our knowledge of the subject is almost wholly dependent upon later memory-based reminiscences, narratives both subject to numerous influences and fragile. In recalling the past, we are all motivated by a desire to be correct, to be observant, to avoid looking foolish. We want to give an answer, to be helpful, and many will do this at the risk of being incorrect. Such factors impact the accuracy of the sources regarding Joseph Smith and plural marriage and mean that any history of the beginnings of Mormon polygamy will be, at best, incomplete. Despite the initial caveat, the church's essay presents a reconstruction that accepts too uncritically the reliability of the primary sources and adopts a defensive reading of the sources that minimizes, if not misrepresents, the underpinnings of Smith's teaching. The essay paints a reverential portrait of Smith as a prophet of God that emphasizes his spiritual qualities and avoids serious consideration of erotic appeal in the implementation of plural marriage. It presents Smith as a reluctant polygamist who only fully embraced plural marriage after an angel with a drawn sword visited him three times and threatened him with destruction unless he went forward and obeyed the commandment fully by sexually consummating his marriages. The essay posits that Smith's July 12, 1843 revelation on plural marriage, since canonized as Section 132 in LDS editions of the Doctrine and Covenants, first emerged in proto-form 12 years earlier in 1831 while Smith was studying the Old Testament. According to later reminiscences and hearsay, Smith learned that the Old Testament practice of plural marriage was part of the dispensation of the fullness of times that God commanded him to restore. The essay neglects to point out that nowhere in the Hebrew Bible is polygamy specifically commanded for God's people generally. Nor does it explain why other ancient Israelite practices, circumcision, for example, did not also figure in Smith's restoration program. After a series of angelic visions, again according to later accounts, Smith told a few close associates about plural marriage and eventually acted to institute what he and others knew was an illegal practice that would undoubtedly stir up the public ire, those are the essay's words, against him and the church. The essay speculates that Smith may have secretly taken a young unmarried Smith family house guest, Fanny Alger, as his first plural wife in the mid-1830s, an extra-legal marriage that ended in separation or divorce. Smith's next and better documented plural marriage took place half a decade later in Nauvoo, Illinois, to Louisa Beeman. This union inaugurated the active period of Smith's plural marriage practice, by the end of which the Mormon prophet had married 30-plus women. The exact number will probably never be known, including almost a dozen already civilly married women. The essay further addresses a series of polygamy-related topics. It suggests a difference between plural marriage ceilings, as Smith-authorized marriages were sometimes termed, that were said to be for time and eternity, versus those said to be for eternity only. The former, according to the essay, implies the possibility of sexual relations in this life. The latter implies marital relations in heaven after death only. Such a difference could be interpreted to defend Smith against charges that he committed adultery when he married already civilly married women, since such plural marriages would have been for eternity only and would not have been consummated in this life. The essay also excuses Smith's marriages to teenagers, one of whom was 14 at the time, but whose plural marriage the essay describes as having occurred several months before her 15th birthday. It acknowledges that such marriages are inappropriate by today's standards, but were in fact legal in that era, and hence not as unusual as we may judge today. The essay next speculates about Smith's plural marriages to already civilly married women, arguably the most problematic aspect of Smith's practice. Perhaps such marriages functioned to link entire families together in social chains of eternal duration. Or possibly such marriages, if understood to be eternity-only ceilings, were Smith's way of obeying the letter of the command that he practice plural marriage without requiring him to have normal, that is, sexual marriage relationships. This in turn saving his own civil wife, Emma Smith, the sorrow it would otherwise bring to her. Or perhaps the marriages were sought after, if not actually instigated, by the already married women themselves, who may have believed an eternal sealing to Joseph Smith would give them blessings that they might not otherwise receive in the next life, particularly those women in unhappy marriages and or married to non-Mormons. Each of these explanations ostensibly dulls the sting of adultery and or stresses that Smith tried hard not to practice plural marriage in its full sense. The essay concludes with a brief discussion of the religious reasons for plural marriage. These include plural marriage as a means of raising up seed, that is, children, unto God, and as a redemptive process of sacrifice and spiritual refinement. The latter encompasses such additional justifications as plural marriage serving as a test both of one's and of one's spouse's faith in and obedience to God's prophet, as a means of securing a spiritual witness of God's wisdom and favor, and as a vehicle for progressing in one's faith. The essay stresses that for Smith and for his followers, the command to practice plural marriage was wrenching, and the decision to accept it usually came only after earnest prayer and intense soul-searching, followed by struggle, resolution, and ultimately light and peace. It ends with the admission that while the LDS Church no longer practices plural marriage, it permits eternity-only plural marriage ceilings in its temples when one spouse is deceased. While the precise nature of these plural relationships in the next life is not known, the essay's final sentence urges faith. Quote, Latter-day Saints are encouraged to trust in our wise Heavenly Father who loves his children and does all things for their growth and salvation, end quote. Reconstructing an accurate historical narrative of Joseph Smith's practice of plural marriage based on factually reliable contemporary sources is a near Sisyphean undertaking. The nearer we come to believe, to what we believe is a true understanding of the topic, the farther away that understanding retreats. It is tempting to rely on the reminiscences of Smith's plural wives and reportedly knowledgeable insiders and to assume that their accounts are trustworthy. After all, why would they misrepresent the facts of their experiences when they have much to lose by admitting to illegal transgressive behaviors? Unfortunately, the boundaries separating truths from untruths in the forum of memory, especially when so many years have elapsed between event and telling, are not clearly demarcated. Quote, every time we recall an event, researchers Elizabeth Loftus and Catherine Ketchum explain, quote, we must reconstruct the memory, and with each recollection, the memory may be changed, colored by succeeding events, other people's recollections or suggestions, increased understanding, or a new context, end of quote. Consequently, the remembered past, quote, takes on a living, shifting reality that changes shape, expands, shrinks, and expands again, an amoeba-like creature with powers to make us laugh and cry and clench our fists, end of quote. As memories form, evolve, and change, quote, we become convinced that what we saw or said or did, what we remember. We perceive the blending of fact and fiction that constitutes a memory as completely and utterly truthful, end quote. Daniel Schachter further notes that as we rewrite, intentionally or unconsciously, our past experiences, we produce a skewed rendering of a specific incident or even of an extended period in our lives. When we talk about the past, especially to an audience, actual or implied, our objectives are more than truth-telling. We want to make sense, to explain, to justify our life. We want also to entertain and to arouse sympathy. Memory must be considered from within its social context because, quote, a person's confident and vivid personal memories may not be accurate ones, end quote. People's memories can be distorted through the inclusion in those memories either of information that has been fed to them subsequent to the event they are being asked to remember, but prior to the moment when the testimony is delivered, or of ideas suggested in the course of the questioning of questioning at the moment of delivery. End quote. Not only does talking about witnessed events lead to changes in memory, the focus of retelling directs those changes. Thus, whenever we recall, tell, and retell important events, especially emotion-laden events from our past, we risk error. Any responsible attempt to recover the poorly documented, more than murky beginnings of LDS plural marriage practice must exhibit both an awareness and appreciation of the pitfalls of that reconstruction. The contemporary documentation, except ironically, that denying that Joseph Smith and others practiced polygamy is virtually non-existent. The later reminiscences come primarily from well-intentioned church members who affirmed their belief in Smith as a Latter-day prophet of God and who embraced the practice as revealed from heaven. Their personal identities were so tied to their belief in, defense of, and participation in Smith's teaching that it is difficult to know where factual truth ends and well-meaning, albeit confabulated, self-justification begins. This is not to assert that the women and men who created the documentation upon which the reconstruction of early Mormon polygamy depends knowingly misrepresented some or most of the specific details of the past. There is, in fact, reason to believe that they believed genuinely in the historical accuracy of their record. But it would be a mistake to conclude, absent corroborative documentation, that their remembered narratives are, in every detail, entirely accurate and reliable. In attempting a scholarly reconstruction of the early years of Joseph Smith and the Church's practice of plural marriage, the Church's essay would enjoy greater credibility if its author had reflected greater skepticism regarding its sources and arguments. Despite the initial caveat, the essay does not sufficiently take into account the weaknesses and compromised nature of the documentary evidence. In fact, it exhibits a disposition to accept as reliable statements supportive of Smith, while tending to reject sources critical, as the essay reads them, of the Mormon prophet. The essay privileges later recollections over earlier statements, again, when the later statements may be read more positively of Smith. For example, in positing that Smith told associates that an angel appeared to him three times between 1834 and 1842 and commanded him to proceed with plural marriage when he hesitated to move forward, the essay relies on sources dating from 1853 to 1905, obtained from practicing LDS polygamists committed to the celestial principle and to the Church. The essay does not reflect an awareness of the reasons why such reminiscent testimony may be compromised and or contaminated, but accepts the assertions as fact. Another example of the essay's preference for later readings, one that functions to discount Smith's sexual relations with already civilly married plural wives, is the essay's distinction between eternity-only marriage sealings and time and eternity marriage sealings. In defining eternity-only sealings and time and eternity sealings as it does, the essay exhibits a presentist understanding of sealings that may or may not accurately reflect Smith's own understanding of the terms. The scanty contemporary lexical record is unclear if Smith and his associates so carefully distinguished between the two terms as the Church and the Church's essay do today. When Zina, Diantha, Huntington, Jacob, Smith, Young, married sequentially to both Smith and Brigham Young, was questioned in 1898 about her plural marriage to Smith, which had reportedly occurred almost 60 years earlier, she seems not to have differentiated much between sealings for time and eternity and sealings for eternity, and did not dispute the assertion that she had married Smith for time and eternity. In another autobiographical statement, she implies a sexual component to her plural marriage to Smith. Quote, "I made a greater sacrifice than to give my life, for I never anticipated again to be looked upon as an honorable woman by those I dearly loved," end of quote. The argument that Smith was a reluctant polygamist downplays Smith's joie de vivre and charismatic sexuality. He was, after all, only 35 years old in 1841. It imposes on him a brand of morality that was foreign to him and ignores the ramifications of his own and others' perceptions of him as heaven's lawgiver. Quote, "That which is wrong under one circumstance may be and often is right under another," Smith reportedly taught of plural marriage, and elsewhere elaborated that there are, quote, "many things in the Bible which do not, as they now stand, accord with the revelation of the Holy Ghost to me." Quote, "When Brother Joseph lived," one of his followers stated, quote, "he was our dictator in the things of God, and it was for us to listen to him and do just as he told us," end quote. Quote, "If he," Joseph Smith, "taught anything, I believed it was the truth or he would not teach it," end quote, a second adherent said. Smith was, quote, "too wise to err and too good to be unkind," a third commented. Quote, "It was not my prerogative to call Smith in question," a fourth added, "with regard to any act of his life. He was God's servant and not mine. He did not belong to the people, but to the Lord, and was doing the work of the Lord. And if he, the Lord, should suffer him, Smith, to lead the people astray, it would be because they ought to be led astray," end quote. While such statements may be somewhat discomforting to modern sensibilities, they evince a devotion that helps to explain Smith's power to persuade and convince. My unsolicited advice to the author of the Church's Gospel Topic essay on Joseph Smith and the beginnings of LDS plural marriage: don't be afraid to acknowledge the limited, incomplete nature of the primary sources, especially when memory-dependent reminiscences form the foundation of your work. Be skeptical of the details such sources contain, including precise dates, direct and summarized quotations attributed to Smith and to others, interpretations of doctrine that cannot be supported by contemporary documents, recitals of events that sound too good and are too convenient to be true, especially when they cannot be independently corroborated. Be aware of your own presentist and other biases, If you cannot set them aside, admit them to readers. Be cautious. Avoid making definitive dogmatic-sounding conclusions. Invite pre-publication comment from a variety of scholars, and not simply those who share your own inclinations. Thank you.
My chapter is a response to the church essay titled Joseph Smith's Teachings About Priesthood, Temple, and Women. The thesis of the church essay is that Joseph Smith's statements about women and priesthood do not mean what they seem to mean. To make this point, the essay employs a gaslighting technique to make readers believe that what they think they've seen is an illusion. The authors seek to convince their readers, first, that Joseph Smith never ordained women to priesthood and never intended to do so. Second, that the temple priesthood was not meant to confer authoritative keys or have any efficacy in the church organization. Three, that the Relief Society was never intended to be a priesthood organization. And four, that anyone who thinks otherwise is under a misperception. The purpose of the church essay is to show that Joseph Smith's words, views, and actions with respect to women in priesthood correspond with those of LDS church leaders today. In taking this stance, the essay ignores significant scriptural and historical evidence that indicates the opposite. Namely, first, that Joseph Smith intended the Relief Society to be a women's priesthood organization. Second, that he viewed the temple priesthood as the fullness of the Melchizedek priesthood restored by Elijah, which encompasses all the church orders of priesthood together with their keys, powers, and rights. And three, that he intended a quorum of anointed men and women holding temple priesthood fullness to govern the church. The evidence for this alternative view, though not abundant, is significant. Because the church essay presents only documents and arguments supporting the view that men alone have the right to priesthood offices and to govern the church, it misrepresents information anachronistically. In order to support its thesis, the church essay utilizes three tactics. First, it says that Joseph Smith used priesthood language loosely in regard to women, and that such language does not refer to priesthood ordination. The authors insist that, quote, Joseph's actions illuminate the meaning of his words. Neither Joseph Smith nor any person acting on his behalf nor any of his successors conferred the Aaronic or Melchizedek priesthood on women or ordained women to priesthood office, end of quote. Second, the essay asserts that the priesthood language used by Smith in regard to women only relates to the order of priesthood mentioned in D&C 131 that is connected with the temple and celestial marriage. And third, the church essay omits any historical evidence that can be used to disagree with their main thesis. But the missing evidence gives a context to show the relationship between Joseph Smith's actions and words on women and priesthood. The first body, and I have six of them, the first body of omitted evidence consists of Smith's contemporary statements. These show first what he meant by giving women the priesthood through the endowment, and second, how he saw women's priesthood as central for their authority to govern the Relief Society and to exercise spiritual gifts, including healing the sick. In his lecture to the Relief Society on April 28, 1842, Smith told the women that they, quote, would come in possession of the privileges, blessings, and gifts of the priesthood, and that the signs should follow them, such as healing the sick, end of quote. The word privileges is crucial because it implies women's right to exercise priesthood as well as receive its blessings. But the church essay insists that Joseph Smith only acknowledged blessings by women that arise upon their faith in Jesus rather than upon their priesthood authority. Not only do his full statements to the Relief Society contradict this interpretation, but Mormon women who were present in Nauvoo later connected the prophet's priesthood promises with their right to administer to the sick. Bathsheba Smith said that Joseph gave us everything, every order of the priesthood, and instructions that they could administer to the sick. The second body of omitted evidence consists of Joseph Smith's full instructions to the Nauvoo Relief Society. He told the women that they should organize their society according to the pattern of the priesthood, that they should move according to the ancient priesthood, and that he was going to make of this society a kingdom of priests as in Enoch's day, as in Paul's day. It is evident from later records of the women who heard these promises that they interpreted and understood the words to mean both that they would receive priesthood keys through the endowment and that the Relief Society was part of the order of the priesthood. In the summer of 1905, Relief Society President Bathsheba Smith reviewed the original Nauvoo Relief Society minutes. She reported to the woman's exponent, quote, Joseph said he wanted to make us, as the women were in Paul's day, a kingdom of priestesses. We have the ceremony in our endowments as Joseph taught. Later in the fall of 1905, Bathsheba Smith, along with her counselors, declared in the exponent that Joseph Smith had told the women in Nauvoo that the purpose of the founding of the Relief Society was to make complete the organization of the church by organizing the women in the order of the priesthood. But a few months later, in January of 1906, just 2 months after Bathsheba Smith had published her strong statement, her presidency made a correction in the exponent, reporting they were mistaken that their original record said their organization was in the order of the priesthood. Rather, they were simply called by the priesthood. 1 year later, Joseph F. Smith declared that a wife does not hold the priesthood in connection with her husband. She only enjoys the benefits thereof. This wrangling, and there are a lot more evidence of it, over Joseph Smith's language and intentions reveals a process of pressure from male leaders that required female leaders to diminish their view of the priesthood promises of Smith, a concession reluctantly given by those women. The third body of omitted evidence and information relates to Joseph Smith's statements regarding the nature of the priesthood to be restored by the prophet Elijah. Smith stated clearly that the organization of the priesthood and church was not complete or in its proper order until Elijah came to restore the fullness of the Melchizedek priesthood. He connected this restoration by Elijah not just with family sealings, but with the temple endowment as it relates to the fullness of the priesthood. Smith said, quote, "Now for Elijah, the spirit, power, and calling of Elijah is that ye have power to hold the key of the revelations, ordinances, oracles, powers, and endowments of the fullness of the Melchizedek priesthood and of the kingdom of God on the earth, and to receive, obtain, and perform all the ordinances belonging to the kingdom of God." End of quote. The fourth area of omitted information consists of Joseph Smith's many statements that connect the temple endowment with the bestowal of the fullness of the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthoods upon the women and men who receive it. His statements show that he saw this temple priesthood as not different in nature from the church priesthood, but more encompassing and empowering. For Smith, all the orders of the priesthood are connected. They are one and united and necessary to hold all the keys. He said that all priesthood is Melchizedek, but there are different portions or degrees of it. Likewise, all priesthood is messianic because all levels are after the order of the Son of God. The fullness of the priesthood conferred in the temple bestows the keys to govern the church and administer all the ordinances, as well as holding the keys of knowledge and revelation. During the time of Joseph Smith, the fullness of the Melchizedek priesthood was also referred to as the highest order of priesthood, implying that it encompassed all of the lower priesthoods in the church. Brigham Young recorded in his diary that his wife, Mary A. Young, was admitted to the highest order of the priesthood on November 1, 1843. Such language was used often in Nauvoo in reference to men and women receiving their endowments individually, even before they were sealed in marriage or received their second anointings. The fifth area of omitted information in the church essay relates to Emma Smith's anointing and ordination to the highest priesthood and to her election and installation as co-president of the anointed quorum along with her husband. That Emma Smith was ordained to the fullness of the priesthood is usually affirmed by scholars, but her role as joint president of the Quorum of the Anointed is seldom acknowledged. Yet this role can be implied from the record of the event set forth in the September 28, 1843 minutes of the quorum. Quote, Baruch El, Joseph Smith, was by common consent and unanimous voice chosen president of the quorum and anointed and ordained to the highest and holiest order of the priesthood and companion ditto, end of quote. If the terms listed apply to Joseph Smith as we understand them today, then they apply equally to Emma Smith, who is the companion in this reference. This evidence belies the essay's assertion that women have never held office in the church. The sixth and last area of omitted information revolves around the mission and function of the anointed quorum. Was it a real priesthood quorum or not? Though it has sometimes been viewed simply as a temple prayer circle, there is sufficient evidence to establish its functions beyond that, because it was constituted as an ongoing priesthood body that held regular meetings in the last months of Smith's life. The members discussed doctrine and consulted and voted about issues affecting the church. The role membership in the anointed quorum assumed for Brigham Young and other members of the Quorum of the Twelve during the trial of Sidney Rigdon is crucial evidence that these men saw the quorum as a functioning priesthood quorum in Nauvoo, giving them the right to succeed Joseph Smith. All of these six bodies of evidence omitted in the church essay show that Joseph Smith actually did things during his life that give us context for interpreting his words regarding women and their priesthood roles within the church structure. Though debatable, the evidence is sufficient to contradict the church essay's assertion that what we see in the church today was what Joseph Smith established in Nauvoo. The church essay does reflect a change that has evolved in the last few years in official discourse about women's relationship to priesthood. In the past, women were usually said simply to be the recipients of the blessings of the priesthood, but now they are described as exercising priesthood power and authority, according to Elder Dallin H. Oaks. His April 2014 conference talk is footnoted three times in the church essay. But importantly, Oaks says women do not hold priesthood keys or offices. These changes in language occurred during the well-publicized first year of the Mormon ordained women movement. The ending of the church essay implies that the priesthood authority women have in the church is equivalent to what men have. Quote, in ecclesiastical callings, temple ordinances, family relationships, and quiet individual ministry, latter-day women and men go forward with priesthood power and authority. This interdependence of men and women in accomplishing God's work through his power is central to the gospel of Jesus Christ restored through the prophet Joseph Smith, end of quote. Most people would concede that the all-male first presidency, Council of the Twelve, other general authorities, regional representatives, stake presidents, and bishoprics have more priesthood power and authority than any of the women in the church. A stake president has more priesthood authority and ecclesiastical power than the general president of the Relief Society. And it is men in important leadership positions who have the authority to define church doctrine, to decide church policies, and to determine how church resources are used on both a general and a local level. Since men alone are sustained as prophets, seers, and revelators, it is only men who speak authoritatively as the mouthpieces of God. So women's priesthood can never be as powerful or authoritative as men's. And because the church priesthood is more legitimate than the temple priesthood, and because women are priestesses to their husbands in the temple, not to God, women's priesthood is subordinate to men's power in both realms, which makes women more dependent on men for spiritual blessings than interdependent with them, as the church essay implies. The church essay makes the church organization seem much more egalitarian than it actually is, for men as well as for women. One positive effect of the church essay is that its writers take seriously the statements and actions of Joseph Smith, which is not always the case in a church that privileges the words of current leaders over dead ones, even Jesus. Since the past is always a helpful lens through which to view and analyze the present, the Gospel Topics essays can serve, though, as a beginning point for lively discussion. Thank you very much.
We've got about 10 minutes for questions, so would you come forward to the microphone and direct your questions to which of the presenters you want to answer from?
Well, I think he was beginning to do that. Is this on? Mm-hmm. Okay. I think he was beginning to do that. I mean, he's developing this doctrine. What I would see when I look at all of his sermons on priesthood, which I quote some of in my talk here, he's developing this new narrative about what priesthood is from about 1839 until 1844 when he's killed. So it's in a process of development. And I consider that, I mean, I think that ordinance where Emma and Joseph are jointly ordained to the highest priesthood and chosen co-presidents, really, I mean, they're as the president of the quorum, I think that he has this idea of including them. And I also believe that one of the mistakes we have now, I think that he was developing this notion, we think of priesthood as, you know, that if you don't, first of all, get ordained, you know, in the Aaronic priesthood, and then you go up through the ranks, and then you're in the Melchizedek priesthood, and then you kind of maybe get to be an apostle, that's the way it has to be. The narrative that I think, or what he's doing in the end of his life, is he's really saying that if you ordain the women to the highest order of the priesthood, they can skip all the rest of that. Because having the temple priesthood, having the highest order of the priesthood, gives them that long quote I read about what Elijah does. They have all the keys and the offices to do anything in the kingdom of God. So I don't know, would he have made them apostles? He might have. But I think he saw this is my interpretation. Obviously, you can argue. But I think he saw the Quorum of the Anointed as kind of superseding what he had already established. I mean, he was changing things and having a different view of things.
I won't tell.
Well, so this is what I'll tell you. We get asked that a lot, but just our Newell and I worked out a policy a long time ago that we wouldn't kiss and tell unless people have outed themselves.
So Paul Reeve wrote the Race and Priesthood essay. He's on out in the public. He did a blog thing recently about that, so I'm not revealing anything. Brian Howes is already on record writing the one that Gary just critiqued. Let's see, what else? I'm giving you stuff that's on record, so let's see.
On record, I think I've heard Brian Hoglund saying he admitted to his involvement with the book of Abraham essay.
That's correct.
With the Bill Real podcast as well.
Yeah, there's roughly a third that I can tell that have gone out and said this is what we've done. But so I don't feel comfortable doing that in public if they haven't felt comfortable outing themselves or making it public. But I would say that it's a process that they had outside people, mostly. A couple of internal people wrote a couple of first drafts. But mostly outside people who wrote drafts. It was very important to the church to reach out to scholars to get this sort of different perspective. And then it went to the in-house church historians for the next peer review. And then it just went up the chain ultimately to the quorum and to the first presidency. That's the process. So.
Looking forward to the book. Beyond what you're doing right now, have you heard there are going to be more essays? And if so, have you heard what they're going to cover? Or is this it?
Well, as far as we, is this on? As far as we know, the 13 essays that are out there now are going to be it. Two notable topics that they didn't deal with that I know some people maybe anticipated possible essays would be the connection between Masonry and Mormonism, because that's kind of a controversial topic. And, of course, the topic of transgender, gay, homosexuals is another very important topic, but we haven't heard any evidence that there's any essays in the works on those. Those would be obvious topics that would lend themselves to that.
Newell, in your introductory comments, you mentioned, asserted that perhaps suggested that the reason the church came out with these essays was in an effort to be more transparent. After listening to the four presentations, would you care to revise that assertion? Perhaps something along the line of giving the appearance of transparency without the substance thereof?
Well, I guess I should nuance that term transparency. I think that it's an effort, as I suggested in the thrust of my remarks, to try to stem the disaffections and try to deal with these controversial topics in a satisfactory way, in a way that would be satisfactory to those people who are tending to stay in the church. But of course, that's really a slippery slope, because it's a little bit like a strip tease. The more you take off, the more they want to see.
we can watch that.
It just doesn't work coming from Joel.
I asked a question regarding, I think it's Orson Hyde, but I'm not sure, who might have said, there were the people who in the pre-existence before Jesus, and those against. In the third and the middle, those might have become African Americans. The color of the skin reflects their indecision. Was that Orson Hyde? When did that happen? Was that found outside of the Latter-day Saint community? Did you pick it up from Southern biases about race? Where did that come from?
That was in an 1845 statement. The question was...
Is this thing on?
No.
Oh, gosh.
It's just there for show.
Yeah, maybe...
I would like the answer.
Maybe... the question was concerning a statement by Orson Hyde that the reason there were the blacks were cursed was because they were neutral during the war in heaven, and that was one of those folk teachings that was out there and kind of circulated, but it was It was primarily attributed to an 1845 statement of Orson Hyde. And it was actually refuted by... later church writers, you know, including Bruce R. McConkie and others. It was never part of the justification for black priesthood denial in any of the official or semi-official. As far as we can tell, it was, you know, Orson Hyde that made that statement, although I have to confess that when I was growing up and attending a church, I think it did come up every once in a while. Somebody say, well, you know, that's one of the reasons why blacks can't hold the priesthood, because they were neutrals in him. And it was sort of taught on an, you know, kind of people, one of those folk tale type of things. And
Is that discussed in any of the essays, as far as you're aware?
1845? So the question is the Orson Hyde statement addressed in the Race and Priesthood essay? And the answer is no. The Boyd Peterson published a piece, 6-7 years ago, where he talks about the myriads of interpretations of the pre-existent life among general authorities. And it just makes your head spin about how many different accounts there are, including Orson Hyde's, including Bruce McConkie's and others. The Race and Priesthood piece that I do focuses mostly on 20th century whiteness theology, and clearly they're working off these racial tropes from the leaders in the Book of Mormon from the 19th century. But the point that I want to drive home in this Race and Priesthood essay is a couple things. One is it's still out there. People still teach it. And I just gave a couple of examples, but there are many, many more. And secondly, I wanted to focus on how widespread this teaching was in the 20th century. And I think most readers, but a lot of readers may know about this stuff from the 19th century, but they don't know that this is going on mostly post-World War II. And I think that's really important. The other thing that I'll say that I didn't mention today is lineage is an issue. I've been going through, I'm going to do a piece probably apart from the book that I'm working on, Blacks and Mormons. I'm going to do a piece on African-Americans or Africans in lineage. And you can imagine how that would look with blessings and things of that nature. I'll just give you a quick teaser. You've got three factors going on. Black people are blessed for the lineage of Cain. Some are blessed for the lineage of Ephraim, which is typically reserved for white people or non-dark peoples. And then you've got a third factor going on where there's no lineage given at all. So there's no centralized way to deal with persons of African descent. And it's very troubling to some of the leaders in Salt Lake.
I just wanted to add, Matt, I think it's really great that you're focusing on the 20th century, because I think one of the disingenuous things about that essay by the church is that it makes it appear it was just Brigham Young and somehow we've gotten over that. But to document then how prevalent these really racist views were in the 20th century, to me, is a really important addition to the discourse about this.
Matt or Newell, this idea of regeneration of skin color based on righteousness, is there any non-Mormon parallels to that idea in your work?
Yes. I just quoted the historian John Turner just briefly here, but in the larger essay, there's a big chunky footnote with all the examples that I found from Protestants from the 15th to the 19th centuries who were teaching something similar. So Mormons are not unique.
Margaret, you indicated at the end that the essays at least offer a good basis for conversation. And as much as there's quite a lot of spin in the essays, it does offer some legitimacy for us to have conversations. I've been away from the church for over 25 years, and when the essays came out, I felt like there was something that I could actually point to and then have beginning conversations with believers. My question to you is, this panel was positioned as a response from scholarly community, and yet supposedly the essays came from a scholarly community. And so I've heard that people who worked on the essays have sworn they wouldn't do such a thing again because the process was so frustrating to them. Mm-hmm. In terms of the translation that occurred with the material they originally brought out and then how it became more and more faith-promoting like mm-hmm. over time. So I would just like you to kind of comment on your scholarly experts, and yet there are scholarly experts that were brought in. If you could kind of
Yeah, well, Matt and I, when we went out and recruited the various scholars to do these essays, we deliberately stayed away from recruiting people that, let's say, were either worked for the church or worked for church-affiliated institutions, because we felt that we might overlap with the people that actually written the essays, number one, but number two, we wanted to get more of an outside perspective. You know, perspective from people that weren't directly involved in the production of the essays that would give a more a broader perspective, and were more willing to really critically get down and really critique them in a thorough, meaningful way. And we felt that if we had recruited, scholars from, affiliated with the church per se, I mean, we didn't avoid, faithful practicing Mormons. I mean, some of those are in the essays, as well as non-Mormons, as well as people that are of LDS heritage, but no longer practicing. But we deliberately tried to avoid that conundrum.
On the other hand, though, we tried to avoid door slammers, too. And we had, I don't know why, this is a rookie error, who knows, but there's a guy at the University of Chicago, Robert Rittner, who did the first draft of the Book of Abraham. And I read it, and I just thought, oh, my goodness, there's no way on God's green earth I'm going to publish this. And it was just, and if any of you know anything about Rittner, he's been so my mistake was just inviting the guy in the first place. But he was so angry, and it really betrayed the norms of scholarly discourse. So, for example, calling in the text, the draft that Newell and I read was the fraud Joseph Smith, the shyster Joseph Smith. Who does that? And he knows better than that. And so, anyway, so I made the mistake of critiquing it. And anyway, I'll just stop there. So we didn't use it. So, but I just wanted to be clear that we did. We're so sensitive to tone, and there's a couple of three essays that we turned away that we initially invited. I've talked about him because he's out in the public quite a bit. But there's a couple of other folks that we turned away. Just we didn't think that for a lot of reasons that the tone was right, the level of seriousness and the rigor was. So anyway, but the group that we settled on is a wonderful group. Tone is impeccable, and most importantly, the scholarship is superb.
Thank you. He actually asked my question, so I'll ask instead if the civil rights movement really did turn out to be a communist ploy. You had expert.
Yes. So I just there's a. Anyway, I finished an essay on Ezra Taft Benson in the civil rights movement. It'll be published next year in a book. And so I had access to all the Birch files and archives and Benson's FBI files. So the essay looks at the context by which Benson became radicalized. And it's really quite an interesting thing. And several of you might know, and I'll be brief here, but several of you might know that the Book of Mormon, he looks at conspiracy in the Book of Mormon. And the first time that Benson ever sees conspiracy and Gadianton robbers, secret combinations and all that nonsense, first time he sees it is in December of 1961, just a few short months after he meets the Birch guy. And so you can see this radicalization taking place. And then by 1970, the first presidency tells Elder Benson to knock the secret combination stuff off. Harold Lee reins him in first, and then the soft-spoken Spencer Kimball will have at him next. Because he resumes it after Kimball's the church president in 1974. He starts talking about secret combinations again. And then by 1980, Elder President Kimball just says, that's it, you're done. And then after 1980, he no longer talks about secret combinations. And then when he's the church president,
His counselor, who's a strong-willed man who had been leading the church since 1981, I want to be crude and say finishes him off, but President Hinckley puts the bit in him pretty for good. And there's only a couple of three times as the church president where President Benson mentioned seeker combinations only in the very in the most offhand of ways. And the short answer is, you can read the essay, but the short answer is he'll use surrogates to do his bidding when he's the church president. First thing he does when he's the church president is he sends out, writes the Birch people and asks for Birch literature to be sent to his counselors. This is 3 weeks after he's ordained. And he's entertaining the Birch president in his offices at LDS headquarters. So anyway, I'll stop there, but it's a fascinating story.
Well, Matt has just given you a preview of his two forthcoming books dealing with Ezra Taft Benson. Makes for fascinating, kind of compelling reading. I tell you to watch for them, and I guess that this brings the end to this session, and I